Alright, time for another DraftPhysics.com video presentation. So, as predicted, Brozo has claimed conclusion proof. He's proven free momentum. And the free momentum experiment is correct. And we shall never more be blighted by being controlled by Arabs and OPEC and all of that stuff. Isn't that wonderful? Too bad it's not true. Yes, of course. So it's just, there's not much I can say about his credibility. It's kind of like, you know, the accusation I have made is that he is incredible, that all of his experiments are flawed and done poorly, and there's poor reasoning behind them. And here he does overtly an experiment where he just threw it together just to see if it worked. Even went through a checklist afterward and even mentioned the camera angle in the checklist. They go, well, I checked to see if the camera angle's good, and this is good, and that's good. Clearly it fails on camera angle. Really the poorest you could possibly imagine. I didn't even bother, all right, wasting much time on it because I'm like, what's the point? I could say something about what my measurements are and, well, pretty much they're made up because you can't see anything. You can't really do it with any kind of precision. And there's a lot of different circumstances you have to be aware of. So in the comments, a couple of people have mentioned that in my video I went, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I went 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and I stopped at 7. And you could see in the video that it was still in the video, you know, the piece was still there. I could have said 8 just as easily. I was just pointing out that it's, you know, pretty much the same idea, half. And I wasn't doing any precision work. I was just talking over the video. Well, anyway, you know, just too silly. and so I'm going to go through a couple of the factors you have to be aware of. And, you know, the idea is that most of this stuff should be imagined in a perfect environment like space. You know, in some piece of space with no gravity or no significant gravity. And no atmosphere and all that stuff, and then you just figure out what it would be possible for two objects to do if they collided with each other, what the likelihood would be. But it is kind of very different than what happens on Earth, because Earth always creates resistance, and the two factors are friction and air resistance, and these are two ways you're going to suck away the energy of the system. It's going to deplete the energy. You have to be aware of the rate of depletion and the very fact that some of this resistance exists, which can fool, which will make it not obviously apparent that when you say an object has a certain weight, you have to consider its weight pushing into a surface creating friction, because it sort of adds to its weight. It's a resistance the object has to overcome. Is the, I guess, a simpler way to put it. And so it has to be part of the figuring. So I'll talk about some of that. There's not much else. There's just nothing in the comments that are at all rational. So a couple of people did congratulate Brozo, but yeah, it's pretty thin commenting. Couple people pointed out I couldn't see a damn thing, you know, so it's all just Brozo says so. So he's boldly said, proof, Walter Lewin's air track experiment was honest. So he's basically proven that Arbor Scientifics is for some reason skeptical, I guess would be the alternative. And you still have to explain the second Professor Lewin experiment that was inconsistent. So why was the second experiment he did inconsistent? And it appears that Brozo has now, what he's proven is springs make the difference. So without springs, you don't get 2/3 the velocity, even though the equation says you do. But with springs, you do. Okay, so springs are the free energy device. Makes all the difference. See, the Arbor Scientific did have springs, but we're not certain of the masses. We can only conjecture that they rationally made one object twice as heavy as the other. Can't say for sure. So that's a problem. All right. So I'll compare the two ways of doing the experiment. See, the defect in the air track is you can't use heavy objects. You know, you have to kind of keep them a certain, they can't be very heavy because then it'll defeat the air track. So that's a liability. Because the lighter the objects you're using, now air resistance becomes more and more important. So it's not ideal, obviously. And you have less units of mass and velocity to deal with, so any errors you make are going to be more obvious because you have less units to play with. Less joules. Less energy, plainly. So what do I want to do here? I want to do this. I believe that's what I want to do. Yeah, that's pretty much it. All right. So in Brozo's experiment, you have, so it's light. So we'll just do his as triangles, okay, on a track. All right. So the disadvantage is they're light, okay? But you've defeated friction with the track, so that's an advantage. All right, I'm doing a pendulum experiment, and the advantage is I got heavy objects, so I don't know how to, massive, we'll just say. Well, that doesn't really help any. Well, you can understand. So, but the problem is that the, you know, it's, so air resistance isn't a problem. But what is a problem is I'm using gravity, so the whole thing is happening on an arc. Okay, so technically it's an arc. The things swing. And so you're going up against gravity, okay, and then down against gravity. And, you know, so you have to figure that into what's going to happen to an object as it swings in the gravity, and how much mass and velocity it has, and how much that means it'll travel in terms of distance and all this kind of stuff. And the real trick is that what you're basically saying is when you're over here at the end, gravity plays a big role, right? You're going up and down more than you're going sideways. And at this point, you're going sideways, okay, a lot more than you're going up and down. So you're not killing the velocity. But it's essentially like friction in the sense the further out you go, the higher the friction gets. So it's hard to metaphor that to something. So there's not a lot of friction here, but there is a lot of friction in terms of gravity consuming the energy the further out you go. So any measurements you want to make them very close to the point of impact. So I didn't say that in my experiment video. And I did it towards the end. You can see where I'm starting to just measure the last inch it travels. Because I realized, no, you can't do the total distance it travels because that is being squished. There's an average velocity. As it's moving, its velocity is increasing. So as it's going this way, all right, the velocity is increasing. So you don't want an average velocity, you want the impact velocity. So the point is you want to try to get as close as you can to the impact velocity and the launching velocity. You don't want to average it over a large distance because that velocity won't be what you're looking for. Now the same is true for the air track, okay? The air track has the same liability in the sense you have to be aware that it's his track isn't too good, and the cart actually does slow down quite a bit. So you don't want to average over a large distance, because then you're getting an average velocity rather than the actual impact velocity versus the launching velocity. So you want to try to make your measurements in as small a distance, traveling distance as possible, and as small a distance from the actual impact. So you want to try to do everything in this small area of space rather than over any kind of distance, because those averages will distort the outcome in the sense that it won't give you a true reading of what took place here. And that's all that really matters is what took place here. What was the velocity at impact and what was the velocity at launching? All right, now this gets sort of, yeah, so I'll erase this and be right back. And we'll talk about what happens in space versus what happens here on Earth. Yeah, it should be back. Alright, so in space you don't have any possibility of wind resistance or any friction. So anything to make the mass seem like it has more mass than it actually has. So you can sort of understand that if I had two objects, one in space and one on the ground, that the difference is this one's going to seem heavier. Because to move it anything, I'm going to have to also compensate for the friction. So to have the same amount of movement out of it, I have to have more energy because I have to account for the fact that there is a little bit of force here. I will encounter little stealing mechanisms, stuff that will steal some of the energy. So if I want to move it the same distance in space versus on Earth, I have to account for the fact that on Earth I'm going to have to apply more energy or I'm going to have to settle for less distance. So in a sense, it's an immediate absorption of some of the energy has to go into overcoming the friction, getting the ball rolling, so to speak. And the faster I can get it rolling, the faster I can reduce the amount of friction. So the friction's at a maximum, right? You could argue, when you're starting, and a minimum when you're at your peak velocity. And obviously the thing in space doesn't have to worry about that. Okay, inertia, okay, doesn't really play a role in the sense that there's nothing stopping it except its absolute mass. There's no mass plus friction to overcome. So when something hits, ideally, in space, a different thing will happen than when it hits in the less ideal world of our practical reality, where air or the ground is going to cause a resistance to progress. And the resistance is going to be at its peak when the velocity is the slowest. For the air, resistance gets higher as you go faster. When you reach the terminal velocity and all that crap. So it is inverted in terms of it's worse. The faster you're going, the worse the air drag. So air drag is opposite of ground drag. I guess we'll say that. Yeah, that's good enough. All right, and you don't have either one in space. So space, things, weird things happen in space where like asteroids hit another asteroid and they, move together, and they really do figuratively move together, just dents it and it stays connected. And they can stay like that for like a million years, and then some tiny little thing will hit, and this piece will go back to being free again. So they combine and move together quite literally. So when they hit, there's a really smooth exchange in the sense that this object will give this what it can. Now the easier example is the big thing hitting the small thing, so I'll use that because I'm a little more confident of the process. So you're saying this has a certain amount of energy, but it's connected to the fact that it has a mass and a velocity. And this second object it's going to hit, let's say, is smaller. And so it's like a bowling ball hitting the pin. And as I sort of said, what's going to happen is there's going to be a transition. So say this has 15 joules of energy. Well, it's tied up in the velocity. So if I said the velocity was 5, okay, and the mass was 3, then all it can do is give it the best 5 to this object. But as soon as it gives just one, say it gives one velocity, it's lost the velocity. So it's already down to 14. And so then you can say, well, now it can only give 4.5. Well, that's good enough for the game we're playing. So now I can only give 4.5 as a maximum to give the second unit of energy, right? And then it's lost, it's one mass times, the two velocity, so it's 3 joules worth. So you can just keep doing the math. So its maximum speed is going to be something less than this 15. It's not going to be able to give it 15. And it's not going to have 15 after it's shared its momentum. So it's just really giving a portion of mass and velocity equal to the size of the object away. And in doing so, it has to be spread over the larger masses, now has to have a reduced velocity. So they'll both leave at some like 14.2 or something. 14, okay. Or 13.2, it depends on how big this mass is, how much it can absorb. So it's just they'll both leave at the same speed together. So in space, it's more likely the big object hits the little object, and what happens is the big object just keeps moving and it just collects the little object and just takes it with it. So the little object is sitting there. Now, if the little object has its own momentum when it hits, then you have the reflection. But without it having any momentum, the big object just collects it and keeps going. There's not going to be much difference in the final speed. There might be a slight difference in the final speed of the object and the final speed of the pin. So as the ball moves in space, bowling, it hits the pins, and the pins don't go very far relative to the ball. They stay a lot closer to each other in terms of they end up with the same velocity. So obviously the first pin goes faster. So the first pin it hits will go faster than the third pin it hits, because it has less and less energy with each time it hits the pin, so the pin's going to go away at a slower speed. So you can understand the first pin goes with a big velocity, and the second pin goes with a little less velocity, you know, less of a line, and the third pin is even less of a velocity. Alright. Alright, so then we'll do springs and call it enough of a video. Just pointing out that there's all things you got to be aware of. Lots of things to be aware of. All right, so springs between things. So super elastic, if you want to call it that. So what happens when you have an impact and you have a spring? And it doesn't really matter. I attach it to this object, attach it to that. Yes, it'll make a difference, but it doesn't really make a difference. That really matters. So what I'm, you know, none of this is ever stated in perfect language. So, you know, I'm just saying that this is how I'm generally figuring it out as I'm going along, as which the best way to understand it. So the idea is that this object is moving. It's going to hit an object not moving that has a spring on it. What's the spring going to do? And is there any possibility that the spring can somehow add more energy to the system? I mean, you have a certain amount of momentum going in, a 100. Is it really possible to use a spring and get 130, you know, going this way? Obviously, I'm saying that's impossible because it's too easy to exploit. Perpetual energy, here we are. So you have to understand that now the spring is really just a reservoir. It's just a battery. It's going to collect some energy, and then it's going to give it back again. All right, so springs make the reverse possible. And what I'm basically arguing is it doesn't matter which way the energy goes in this object. Whether it continues in this direction or continues in this direction is a decision made, okay, by the forces. And it'll either be all this way or all this way. Nothing's destroyed. Well, it went a little bit this way and it went some this way, and so it used up the energy and now there's no energy. No, it's either all reflection or all forward. So there's no parsing it up, there's no confusing the object, and there's no just, oh, I vibrated back and forth and used up all the energy. Those things don't happen. All right, so what I'm understanding is okay, so think of the spring, the big spring, okay, you're going to hit the spring and push it in. What are you really doing when you're applying the pressure? And so you have a mass and a velocity. And the way I understand to think about it one little particle pushing the spring, you can understand what's it really going to do as it compresses the spring is it's going to slow down. So its velocity, I can't change its mass, but I can change its velocity. So the one little particle is going to, it's going to have a velocity going in, and by the time it gets to this point, it's going to have zero velocity, okay? It's going to have no velocity. So where's the velocity? The velocity is in the compression of the spring. So what is this thing over here feeling? Okay, what's its pressure made out of? Well, the pressure is made out of the mass coming towards it, all right, pushing, applying a pressure times the velocity. Well, what's the average velocity over the distance of the spring? And then you can argue that this is a very low pressure. It's going to feel very little energy. Okay, it's going to be received here because the energy has been used moving all these bits of the spring and compressing them. So it's a very minor amount of velocity that it's going to receive at this end as a component of the mass velocity. So you're just basically saying the spring is consuming velocity. So it's slowing this mass down as far as this one can perceive it. So it's getting little doses of the energy, not the complete dose, because you use the energy to deform the spring into this different configuration. Now we know the energy is still in the spring, and the spring can just give it back. It can re-expand with a velocity. It can give back the velocity it absorbed as soon as the pressure pushing on it is less than the pressure that compressed it. So as soon as this pressure goes below the pressure that created the compression, the spring will start expanding into that and giving back the extra velocity it consumed. So it'll give half the velocity in that direction and half the velocity in this direction. All right, and so you can sort of understand why that's a tipping point, sort of, in the sense that the object comes in, compresses the spring, gets to a point where it doesn't have any velocity, and then the spring is going to give it velocity in this direction. So by compressing the spring, you stopped it, which you wouldn't have done if there was no spring. If there's no spring, the object wouldn't have stopped. And what it would have done is just exchanged its energy and still been left over with a little bit. So it would have given its energy to the other object as much as it can in the amount of time required. And it likely would have just continued on after it gave away a portion of its momentum. It's required to reflect if the object is much bigger than the object. You know, if a little tiny thing hits a very big thing, it's going to likely reflect because it can't give the velocity to the big thing. It can't give a big velocity to a big object. It has to only give it a little velocity. And the other limitation is when the big thing hits the small thing, obviously the slow velocity, it can't give the little thing a high velocity. It can only give it the velocity it has. You get hit by the 10-ton train. You don't literally fly forward, okay, faster than the train. You just go a little faster than the train, just a little tiny bit, and just slide off. And it looks like you're going fast because you're going as fast as the train was going. But you're not going faster than the train. I'm not going a lot faster than the train. And so the same thing's true in this circumstance. So this object leaves, but doesn't leave. It leaves at a velocity compared to zero, right? Compared to some zero point, it's leaving at a velocity. But compared to the object that hit it, it's not leaving very fast. I think I'm satisfied with that. That's enough of an explanation, I think. So springs just make it more likely that you get a reflection, because they change how you proportion your energy and when you feel the reflection, so to speak. All right, I'll think if there's anything else to add, and all right, so we'll finish up. Again, this whole thing is about some idea that it's possible to to break the idea of conservation of energy, conservation of momentum. So total energy, so the word energy is biased, okay, by the conventional theory that the word energy means kinetic energy, when it doesn't or it shouldn't, because that's the question that I think should have been resolved hundreds of years ago through some sort of disciplined approach to examining the available evidence. So as I've pointed out, they really have zero evidence of kinetic energy. They won't show you it taking four times more gas to go twice as fast. They won't show you the bullet coming out of the gun doing thousands of times more work than the barrel of the gun. They won't show the 5-ton train doing more work than the 10-ton train. They won't show the 8-pound bowling ball knocking down more pins than the 16-pound ball. They won't show the small wrecking ball knocking down more buildings than the big, heavy wrecking ball. So all the things that their theory proposes as a fact, there's no evidence for any of it. And you can just logically state that once you've allowed energy to exit a system, you can't have any notion of cancellation. Asteroid going this way does not undo the asteroid going this way. The one heading for Vulcan isn't undone by the one heading for Earth. You can't pretend, okay, that they're not energy because they're going in opposite directions. Now, if they're in a closed vessel, you can make some sort of argument that the impact this way will undo the impact this way, and you'll end up not gaining any motion. But it doesn't mean that it isn't a real impact in one direction and a real impact in the other. And that has to be accounted for when you've released the energy to the rest of the universe. So basically, they're saying it's theoretically possible to take 100 joules of energy going in a direction, put it in an experiment, and have 133 pop out this side and 33 pop out that side, and they're claiming it's not free energy. And it can't be anything else, you know, free momentum. So it really, theoretically, there's no ground for this conversation. And now we're having a debate over, you know, now we're stuck with these amateur experiments that people think are somehow a good idea, when it's clear how it's really a bad idea, because people start claiming they've proven something with a piece of evidence that's really flawed and far from perfect, far from what the minimum standard of acceptable as a challenge. I shouldn't be challenged to debunk a proof this poor. I mean, they should be a little bit more credible before we're obligated to explain away, And the more extraordinary the claim, the more you should have some expectation of at least ordinary evidence. And I'm just saying it's a pretty extraordinary claim to say you can make free momentum and it's okay, not a problem. And you have what I'm claiming to be less than ordinary evidence, in that the only credible experiment demonstrating it has a blob of clay on it. Okay, so bringing it back to the Professor Lewin flawed experiment, let's just say. Challengeable experiment. Debatably credible experiment. I'm sorry to have to keep insulting the audience, but frankly, the audience for Stephen Bro's videos and my videos is apparently way too stupid that it can't figure out that, you know, these logical pieces do not fit. You can't claim these facts and then fit them together and in any kind of logical way, because they don't fit. The theory doesn't make any sense, and the evidence sucks. Okay, there. So whatever. It's going to take a while before you're just revealed to be really dumb people, to be arrogant and claiming you have the truth and somebody else is an idiot and all this crap. The idiots are the people making the claims that can't be defended. And they'll never defend them. They'll never make these videos. They'll never explain to you how, oh yeah, the spring compresses and it, you know, and also pushes at the same time, and so it's double energy because when it expands, it'll be free extra energy. They won't give you any explanation of how it's possible to take 100 joules in, get 133 that way, and 30 that way. They'll never explain. They'll never show you a diagram how that could possibly make sense. Momentums, whatever you want to call them. Mass times velocities. Just as physics girl will never be able to explain how 100% of the momentum goes from one object to another object. You know, I drop a weight, or I combine two train cars, I double the mass and I have, you know, half the velocity. So I have 100% transferred all the energy, all the momentum, all the mass times velocity, and yet I made sounds, and I crushed things, and I sparked things, and I played DVDs and MP3s, and I did all kinds of, I charged my cell phone. I did all kinds of other things without using any momentum. So somehow the wheel's turning, it's momentum moving, the flywheel. I completely transfer all the energy of the flywheel to another flywheel, and at the same time, charge my cell phone and to polish my boots and made noises by rubbing my fingers together. I did a whole bunch of other things with the same energy. That's not possible. Okay, so anyway, that's all I am. Do what you will do. I can't, again, I can only reason with you. You won't apply any reasoning. You won't be fair. You won't show yourself to have any honesty or integrity. I can't do much about that.